our suffering can be our greatest tutor and our greatest guide.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like, garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think, ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest on this episode is Kamla Kapoor, an award-winning Indian-born American author, poet, and playwright. She holds a master's degree in literature from Kent State University in Ohio and studied creative writing at the University of Iowa. Kamla was on the faculty of Grossmont College in San Diego for 18 years, and her stories, poems, and plays have been published in prestigious American and Indian journals. Her new book is Rumi, Tales of the Spirit, A Journey to Healing the Heart.
Hi, Kamla. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eric. I'm glad to talk with you.
Yes, I am looking forward to it also. Your latest book is called Rumi, Tales of the Spirit, A Journey to Healing the Heart. And we will get into that book and a lot of your wisdom here in a minute. But let's start like we always do with the parable. There's a grandmother who's talking with her grandson, and she says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love. And the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandson stops, and he thinks about it for a second. He looks up at his grandmother, and he says, well, grandmother, which one wins? And the grandmother says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in the work that you do.
Well, I think that that parable is, if you had to summarize how to go about living and how to go about thinking in a way that enhances the quality of your life, then that parable is a little nutshell of wisdom. And I think that for a couple of reasons, the obvious one is that there is a battle going on between us, between almost every individual, between what the West might call the good and the evil forces, and that we can have a say in who wins in that battle. There's obviously a wolf that is fearful and not very kind and not very nice, not very aware. And then there is the wolf that, if we feed it, becomes the opposite of the bad wolf. I want to say two things about it. The first one is that the parable places the responsibility for living with the good wolf squarely in our laps, in the lap of the individual. It's up to you which one you're going to feed in order to help it to grow, because when you feed something, it grows. So that is very important. And the other part that I think is very important is that there are always these two wolves. You can't kill off one wolf. The grandmother doesn't advise her grandson to kill off one wolf because you can't. These are the two forces of life, if you want to call them yin and yang or good and evil. And I would also like to add another point to this is that the bad wolf that is fearful and doubtful and not very kind and is, you know, has a lot of vices is absolutely necessary for the good wolf to become what the good wolf becomes if we feed it. So it's like Rumi would say, you know, we have to harness the power of the demons inside us so that they can hew stones for our palace. Now, that's a very complicated idea, but what it basically says is that it is our negative side. It is our bad and fearful and vulnerable and very human side that has a role to play in what we become.
Right. And I like that part about the parable too, where it doesn't really say anything about having to harm the bad wolf or harness the bad wolf or anything. I think it sort of just says, hey, like, you know, you're going to need to put a little more attention over here.
Exactly. And it's attention, it's awareness, it's consciousness. If you're not even aware that this is going on inside you, then you can't even begin to remedy it, because most of us go through our lives with a sort of a default mode of thinking, just being unawarely caught up in our passions and our emotions without reflecting upon them.
Right. So let's start off by you telling us who Rumi is. I think a lot of people have probably heard the name. A lot of people know him as a poet, but he was more than a poet. But give us a little sketch of who he is.
Rumi was born in the 13th century in Persia, what is now called Iran, and then he moved to Turkey, where he spent most of his life. And he was just an ordinary human being till he, just like you and me, and going about business as usual, till he met a wandering minstrel called Shamsuddin, or Shams for short, and who really ignited the spiritual spark in him. But a few years after they met, Shams was killed, and some people say, you know, he was killed by his jealous disciples because there was such a love between them, or some say it was his son who killed him. But the effect of Shams's death was delivered a deep wound to Rumi's heart, and a transformative wound, a wound that heals in the long run. So it is said that he, when somebody asked him to write down the poetry that he was reciting or the stories he was telling, that he wrote the Matnavi, which are six volumes, very dense volumes, not only of poetry, but prose and lectures and parables and discourses on the right way of thinking. This is what has endured his writing. I believe it just poured out of him. And so we are left with this wonderful work of art and spirituality combined, which helps us to navigate our day-to-day lives. So I hope that gives you some idea of who Rumi was. Before he became a poet, he was, you know, studying law, he was into jurisprudence, and just a teacher. He was just going about his life till this particular event. And that's why I say in my book as well that our suffering can be our greatest tutor and our greatest guide, because it's like, you know, it's like plants. If you prune a plant in one direction, I'm sure a tree hurts, but it teaches the tree which direction to grow in. It's like teaching us to feed the good wolf.
Right. And so with Rumi, what religion would he be considered to be? What tradition would he be considered to be part of?
Well, this is a very interesting question. Rumi is very obviously from the Sufi tradition of Islam. And the Sufi tradition of Islam is like the mystical version of Islam. Just like in Christianity, we have the Bible, and then we have the Gnostic Gospels, which are far more mystical. But I also want to qualify that even though he comes from the Islamic tradition, the guides and the gurus that I admire say the same thing over and over and over again, that we're all made of the same light. We are all made of the same stuff. And the current divisions, and probably even ancient divisions, political, religious divisions in our times and in history, are deeply flawed because the thinking behind them are deeply flawed, in the sense that, you know, a Jewish person will think of God as Jewish, a Hindu person will think of God as Hindu, and an Islamic person is Islamic. But really, if we're all creatures and brothers and sisters of the one God, then we're co-sanguine. We share the same blood, we share the same spirit. And so even though he comes from the Islamic tradition, the message is not confined just to Islam or to Sufi mysticism.
Right. You know, my experience is you read any of these traditions deeply enough and you start to say, well, boy, this all sounds pretty similar, doesn't it? Sort of sounds like the same message just delivered in slightly different cultural contexts and, you know, the slight sort of, what would be the word for it? The slight warping that happens by filtering through it a human lens. But when you boil it all down, there's an awful lot of similarity.
It's the root. You know, if you think about the roots of all religion are the same, and it's the human urge to connect with something higher than us, which not just higher and beyond us, but something that is within us. It's not just out there. It's something we can connect with through our journey inward. And that's another thing that is similar to almost all traditions. And it doesn't mean that God is only inside us, but is pervasive inside and outside us. You know, if you're all made of the same stuff, then the same thing is filtering through all of us. No matter which religion you turn to, but you have to really go to the root of it and practice what you learn.
Yes. You say in the book that the thesis, or rather the hope of this book, is that we can and must turn from being closed to being open, from contraction to expansion, from isolation to connection, taking the first steps towards wisdom, happiness, and joy. And I love that. I have been thinking an awful lot lately about that very idea of expansion versus contraction, right? We've had a spiritual teacher on, Adi Ashanti, who said to me once, ego is just a contraction, right? And I've been thinking about this idea a lot, this contraction to expansion, that James Hollis, the psychotherapist, often just asks a question when trying to evaluate a decision. Is this going to expand your life or contract it? So I love that idea so much. Tell me a little bit more about it from your perspective.
Well, you know, we could characterize the bad wolf as the contracted wolf because, you know, in order to be greedy or unkind or fearful, you're basically, you know, thinking from a very egocentric and a very personal point of view. And it's not an aware point of view. So when you open out And this opening out, by the way, happens a great deal, you know, say when your heart breaks, for example. I mean, what happens to your heart when it breaks? It cracks open and it hurts. Of course, it hurts, but it also opens out. It opens out to receive others, to receive love, to receive kindness, to give it and to receive it. So to live in an open way is to live in a vulnerable way, to take away that ego skin that separates us from others. It's like King Lear, you know, when he's really is down and out, and here's this really autocratic king whose nose has been rubbed to the ground. When he finally gets there, his heart is open. He can live in a hovel with a crazy madman and love him. It's like in Rumi's stories, you know, all these stories are about characters who begin off being very closed. And then by living through their experience, you see how suffering opens them up to being more aware and connecting with their higher selves.
What I see with suffering is for some people, suffering opens them up, they transform it in beautiful ways, right? And they grow from it. And then there are other people who seem to be embittered or broken by suffering. And I'm kind of curious, I ask this to a lot of guests, but I'm curious from your perspective, what is the difference in the people who are able to use suffering to turn it into something beautiful versus the people it sort of implodes upon?
First of all, I want to begin with the assumption that I think that all people are capable of transformation. But you're very right that some people, a lot of people, get very embittered by their experiences and stay in that bitterness. Now, you know, I think the difference between the two is either you're happy being unhappy or you want to do everything in your power to get out of it. You know, to not realize that there is a different way of being and a different way of thinking around about the same issue, you know, that horrible thing happened to me and now I don't want to trust anybody anymore, or that horrible thing happened to me and I'm going to learn from that experience and move on and not live without trusting people, because to live without trust and hope is not a good life. So I would also qualify that, you know, if we didn't have people who were embittered by their experiences, we would have no room in us for compassion. So those of us who can transform, those of us who can, you know, transcend negative experiences and learn from them, must have compassion, because if there is hope for the people who are embittered, it is compassion for them. Although you can't always reach them, but those that we can reach in our lives, the only truly transformative power in life is love. And Rumi says that over and over again, you know, and it's very sad that there are so many people who don't know how to live with hope and joy. And I think ultimately the answer is unknowable. The Hindu philosophy might say it's karma. It's how you lived in your previous life. But we don't know that. Maybe in your previous life, you fed the dark wolf more. And now it's time for you to learn what to feed in yourself. But I don't really have the answer for that, Eric. And it is one of the greatest mysteries of life because, you know, there are people who can transcend and there are people who live happy, joyful lives. And there are people who can't do that. And all I can do is hope that something will turn them. Thank you.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Certain people have tried to study resilience, and resilience is what we might say is the ability to take a really bad experience and come through it stronger and better. They often talk about that the idea of being able to find a coherent narrative out of it. And that's why I think the work that Rumi does, that you're continuing, of telling stories. Stories that show, hey, look how this person took suffering and transformed it. Look how this person did it. And it sets up a narrative that allows us to try and, I think, frame our own experience in that way. I know in my own life, being able to turn a lot of the things that have happened to me, having a coherent narrative that shows those as growth experiences, shows those as things that propelled me forward versus things that brought me down, really transforms my relationship to them. And so I think story is a really powerful way to do that.
Right on. And all the stories of Rumi's stories that I've retold in this book and the other one that I wrote before that, I sectioned off in a group stories under different titles, like, one of the ones in this book is Embrace Suffering. And there are four stories under that about characters who embraced their suffering, who saw the good in their suffering and how they did it. It's exactly what you were saying. And stories are also more powerful because when you're reading a story, you relive it. You enter the story and you go through these experiences with a character and then come out, hopefully, on the other side with a nugget of gold, with a gem. Okay, aha, I can do this too. I can apply this to my own life. And then the second section is pray. And I deeply believe in the power of pray because a prayer, what is prayer but a dialogue with our higher selves? And the dialogue is productive in itself because by, you know, having like just exploring the other side, and you can come to a conclusion that, well, if I am this way, then I'm not going to be a happy person. But if I'm another way, there is another way of thinking. And it all boils down to perspective, you know. The perspective we have is how our life ends up being. So if it's a contracted perspective, then we're going to live a contracted life. And the third part of this book is surrender to the cosmic will. And that which is, you know, a lot of us get stuck with our bad experiences because we don't know how to accept that which has already happened and that which we cannot change, that we can only change through our thinking by finding what you call a coherent narrative in it. you know, by looking back and saying, okay, did anything good come off that? And making a list of it, you know, practical things.
Do you have a story you could summarize from the book that might talk about suffering?
Yes, several, actually. There is the very first story called We Never Know Why is about this guy who gets, you know, he's sleeping peacefully and suddenly he's woken up very rudely by somebody who's whipping him and beating him and punching him, and he doesn't know what's going on. This stranger just keeps hitting him and saying, run, run. And this guy is running. He says, what the hell is life all about? You know, why am I suffering? Like, what have I done to this guy? And then the stranger makes him eat all these apples, stuff his mouth with apples. And then he makes him drink at a fountain, and he drinks and he drinks and he vomits up ultimately. And what does he see in his vomit but a black snake breathing in it? So he's really shocked, and he looks at the stranger who says, you know, I was walking by you. I saw you sleeping with your mouth open. I saw the black snake slithering into your mouth, and I wanted to save you. So he said, why didn't you just tell me that there was a black snake in me and you're trying to get it out? And I would have borne my suffering better. But the stranger says, if I told you, you would have died of fright. So in this story, the last sentence is Emma, who's the central character, fell at the feet of the stranger and said, oh, blessed is the hour you saw me. Blessed is the suffering you inflicted to awaken me. And all suffering has a power to awaken us. And all four of the stories under this section talk about the transformative power of suffering. And, you know, it's very important to remember this. And it's not always possible to remember it. If we're human, we forget. Sometimes the black wolf predominates in us. You know, I don't think you ever get to the point where the black wolf is vanquished and just the good wolf lives you. The trick is to remember when you're suffering, for example, which is not always possible to do, that this suffering, like all my other sufferings, will bear good fruit.
Right. I think the thing that's so interesting when we have these discussions about suffering and how it can be transformed and how it can bring all these beautiful things forward, all that is true. And yet, when you're suffering, you are suffering. That's the part of the story that gets lost, is that, like, the suffering is real. You're going to be through that. I often think about that idea. People say, like, well, when one door closes, another opens, you know, and I often joke, yes, but nobody mentions the long, dark hallway in between. And that's kind of what the suffering is. And I think we can use it to transform us, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt like hell.
Exactly. And I think that the two go hand in hand. And that's what these stories are about. They're very human people who suffer, you know, and when they're suffering, there's a wonderful story of Rumi's under the praise section about this musician called Jalaluddin, who's a depressive, you know, and he goes to his priest, who tells him to pray, and he doesn't believe the priest because he feels that, you know, the devil comes to him and says, you know, what are you mumbling in your beard for? Is there anybody who says, here I am, when you pray to Allah, you know? And he's, and poor Jalaluddin says, no, I never heard him reply to any of my prayers to him. But towards the end of the story, and he has to go through horrific experiences to realize that he's crying out to God, and God saying, here I am, is the same thing, you know. And from my own life, I know that if I remember to pray when I'm really suffering intensely, because what prayer does is it reminds you that there is another way to think. For example, whenever I'm going through really hard times. And that's what the third section is about. I remind myself, or try to remind myself, or try to remind myself most of the time, that this is the cosmic will. This is what is happening now. I can't change it. All I can do is accept it. And the accepting of it transforms it.
Yeah. I was sort of touched in the book when you were talking about this acceptance and the challenge of this. You mentioned that it's challenging to get old, that accepting getting old is challenging.
It's very challenging. Yeah, I turned 71 this year, and, you know, my health is not what it used to be. My stamina, my intellectual acuity is not what it used to be. But, you know, as soon as I find myself worrying about it or bitching about it, it just gets worse. But like I was diagnosed with, peripheral neuropathy, and there's really no cure to it. I just have to accept it. And, you know, sometimes my legs burn, and like today they're burning. And you gotta just put up with it and do what you can, you know, spray them with all the sprays you've got and rub them or whatever. But you got to live with it. If you don't live with it, there's a wonderful story, another Rumi story, is about a woman who doesn't like getting older at all, and how she tries. It's called The Witch of Kabul. And she tries to lure this young man, you know, does the tremendous suffering that causes, her inability to realize. And Rumi's quote from that is that when the candle of your youth dims, you have to light the candle of the spirit.
A lot happening these days. But I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters, without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
You say in the book, if I don't actively assent to my aging, I am surrendering to despair and constant complaining, to being an unhappy and an old hag, which the hag part makes me laugh. But it's so true. Like, if I don't surrender to this, then I'm surrendering to, like you said, despair and constant complaining. I thought that was just a beautiful way to say it.
Yes. You surrender to one thing or the other, you know. So which one are you going to surrender to? Which one are you going to feed? I keep coming back to your parable. and to assent to your life the way it is, exactly the way it is, exactly the way it turned out, exactly the arc of your story, what didn't happen, what happened, the dreams unfulfilled or the ambitions unfulfilled, or how much you achieved or did not achieve. You know, unless you say yes to it and embrace it fully, you're going to be unhappy.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said just a couple minutes ago, and I may not get this exactly right, but you said that one of the characters in the story realized that crying out to God was the same as hearing God.
You're crying out to God, and God saying, "Here I am," is the same thing. You know, that, you know, let me give you my own example. You know, if I'm suffering intensely and I remember to pray and I remember to just turn towards this higher power and myself and say, could you help me, please? You know, or say, could you help me accept this because I can't change it? Or if I can change it, could you help me to change it, please? The process of here I am to help you starts, you know. I firmly believe in the power of prayer, like I said earlier, because as soon as you start praying, you've got a different perspective. You're not mired in your suffering. You're doing something about it. You're asking for help. You have recourse. So to turn towards that which helps us to overcome our suffering, which we fall into periodically, because, you know, our lives are not linear. We never get to the point where we are totally enlightened. Our life is circular, and it's like a spiral. And if you want to think of, you know, the axis of the spiral as suffering or as God, then you're always moving either close to or moving further away from it. You're revolving around it all the time. And some of these things are periodic. Some of these are tied to, you know, the atmosphere or the environment or the, you know, the way the stars are aligned or whatever. We're connected to the vaster life that we inhabit. We are not just isolated creatures living our own little lives. We're connected to everything there is. We're connected to nature. We're connected to the sky. We're connected to God, if you want to call that energy God or nature or love. Rumi's other word for God is love. So that's why I said to remember. And that is the trick, because we know when we're suffering, we forget.
Yeah, you say at one point in the book, I thought this was a great way to say it, briefly, the examined life means that we not only think, but we also think about our thinking. And that's a little bit of what you're describing here. It's remembering to sort of look at our thoughts from a different perspective.
Yes. It's first of all realizing that you're in a bad place right now. You know, you're not doing well. And you, you know, if you've lived the examined life, you've developed techniques by now, like breathing or meditation or stretching or going out for a walk. All of these are very important because, you know, the physical and the mental and the psychic are on a continuum. You know, then you remember that you have to do all these things. And the first step is recognition you're not in a good place. And the second step is to watch what you are doing to not be in that good place. You know, sometimes you're either not accepting what's going on, or you're not embracing it, or you want something else instead of what you're getting, or you're, you know, mired in your desires for this or that, this, that, and the other. And so, yes, what you said is true.
So I think we're nearing the end of our time here, but I want to hit on something that you say in the book. I'll just read this paragraph because I think it ties us back to the wolves also. And you say, "The ultimate marriage, the holy union, we are told repeatedly by our guides, especially the preeminent psychologist Carl Jung, takes place in the temple of our souls. It is the marriage between our lower and higher selves, between human and God. The goal of this marriage is not perfection, but wholeness. The human and the divine together form a whole."
Well, that kind of says it. And I don't think I could add to that. And perhaps just to say that this, you know, just like when you love somebody, you stay connected to them and you make the effort to stay connected. So this is the love between the higher and the lower selves that keep that connection and ends up in the marriage where, you know, the ultimate, all our guides say, is to live beyond pleasure and pain, is to live beyond suffering and joy. It's to be in a place where you expect to do both and yet have cultivated the perspective where you know that this is going to pass and everything, whether it's good or bad, is going to pass. And you'll arrive at that axis around which you've been revolving all your life. You know, to have hope for this marriage is a wonderful hope to have. And to strive towards the marriage is something we can do. The responsibility for it is ours.
Right. I love that idea of the marriage between our higher and lower selves, between human and God. I've often heard people describe humans or a spiritual description is like, we're part animal, we're part God, right? And we're sort of in the middle. We're sort of stuck in the middle there. And we try and live out both those to the best of our ability.
Yes, and we're not stuck in the middle. We're sort of joined by these two, if you'd like
that's
to think
that's a better way
that
to say
way.
It. Yes, yes.
And to live at this node where we are joined. And there's something else in between animal and God, and that is human. And the human is the one that examines and changes his or her thinking. The human is the one that has the power to evolve, because it's ultimately all about our own personal evolution, which, by the way, I firmly believe raises the evolution and consciousness of the planet. That's our responsibility as human beings. All the sages, Socrates says it, know thyself, and the unexamined life is not worth living. And the other element that we haven't even touched on is awe, you know? I mean, just think about the world you live in. Think about the mystery. It's not just you. Look outside in the garden. Look at the plants. Look at the sky. Look at the sun. And it's like Einstein says, you know, the person who doesn't feel awe at this existence that we're here at this point, in this time, in this body, is like a snuffed out candle. So we don't want to be snuffed out candles. We want to do everything in our power to stay connected to the wonder of existence.
Yes, I find that another great way to approach the divine is through just looking at the mystery that life is and just how tremendous it is. Like, what's going on inside my body right now is so unbelievably complex. I mean, there is so much happening every second. Boom, boom. I mean, trillions of chemical reactions. It's just staggering what all is going on right as I sit here and talk to you, that I'm not even doing any of it.
It's just happening. And the fact that we have all our limbs, we've got fingers, you know, I mean, really, if you start counting your blessings from your toe upwards and how many things are working, that's one of the ways I think when I worry about or think about or suffer about getting older, you know, look at how many things are working, for Christ's sake, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, give thanks, give, you know, that's another very, very important message that all the guides and the gurus give us. Gratitude is the ultimate alchemy. As soon as you say, hey, thank you that I'm alive today, you know, that I'm breathing at the very basic level, and then count all the other blessings. And that's one way to not stay stuck in bitterness and in suffering and in the contracted state.
Yes, gratefulness is an expanding state for sure. If we can get ourselves there, it's the outflowing. Well, thank you, Kamala, so much for coming on the show. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and we'll have links in the show notes to your book and how people can find you online. So again, thanks so much. I really enjoyed the book, and I really enjoyed getting to talk with you.
Thanks, Eric. I was happy to be interviewed by you. I'm looking forward to hearing both of us talk.
Yes. Okay. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If what you just heard was helpful to you, please consider making a donation to the One You Feed podcast. Head over to oneyoufeed.net/support. The One You Feed podcast would like to sincerely thank our sponsors for supporting the show.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.